From Portland, Oregon, we're APA Compass Radio, the Pacific Northwest's only Asian Pacific American public affairs radio show. Find podcasts of our program, apacompass.wordpress.com, or contact us on Facebook. Thanks for listening to APA Compass Radio.
Thanks for listening to APA Compass. I'm Sarika Mehta. Back in September, I spoke with Benita Gupta, the Deputy Legal Director of the American Civil Liberties Union in Washington, D.C. She also serves as Director of the ACLU's Center for Justice. She visited Portland as the keynote speaker for the Northwest ACLU's conference at Lewis and Clark College. We chatted in downtown Portland's Director Park about how incarceration policies affect our communities and the outlook for more Asian Pacific Americans getting involved in social justice. We began our conversation with her motivation for working in this field.
I, in law school, knew I wanted to do social justice work, but I had spent some time in Boston working on youth violence prevention and discovered that the criminal justice system was just completely skewed towards a very kind of bad set of priorities that were resulting not in public health interventions that were really focused on the health of children and how to prevent crime in their lives, but instead on kind of arrest and incarceration. And it just drew me in. And then the more I learned about what was going on in our criminal justice system, the more I realized that this was just one of the most profound civil rights crises in our country today.
Actually, that's kind of the crux of what I wanted to talk about today, because it seems like there's a lot more money spent on imprisonment and that whole system rather than having an early intervention and having education from the start and more of that community effort. So if we look at things from, you know, the economical standpoint, why is everything so skewed in that direction?
I think that for a long time, for about the last 30 or 40 years, ever since President Nixon declared a war on drugs, there's been a very strong focus on kind of being tough on crime and holding people accountable. And while, of course, as a society, we do want to hold people accountable, there is a really kind of skewed set of priorities in this country around and this desire to criminalize and over-criminalize behavior that 40 years ago wasn't considered criminal. For instance, you know, school discipline, increasingly there's police officers and the presence of a criminal justice system in a lot of public schools in this country. Kids are getting arrested for things that might have led to a trip to the principal 20 years ago, but today will lead to an arrest and ultimately kind of a downward spiral into the juvenile justice system. So you have stories as shocking as a six-year-old getting arrested in Florida for having scissors in her backpack. Those kinds of stories are increasingly on the rise, I think, because we've really kind of over-criminalized so much. All of us probably know people who suffer from alcoholism and substance abuse, but in certain communities in this country, the only intervention that folks have is 911 and the criminal justice system. Whereas for a lot of us, we have, you know, therapists that we would call and get programs that we would seek out for our family members and that kind of thing. And there just really is kind of two sets of responses depending on your demographic and where you live.
Have you seen this impact these communities in any particular way?
You know, there's been a very big imposition of the criminal justice system into immigration and immigrants' rights. And increasingly, what we've been doing in our criminal justice system around arrest, incarceration, is what we have been increasingly doing in the areas of immigration. And particularly because there's been a real kind of void of federal policy on this, states have been resorting to a lot of enforcement measures, using local police, using local jails to basically address what is ultimately a more complex problem that needs to be addressed at the federal level. And so that's where we're seeing a lot of problems with regards to immigrant communities and our criminal justice system.
I hate to put the spotlight on you, but how do we even begin to solve these issues? What are the first steps we want to take in the right direction?
Well, I mean, I think there's a lot of really exciting activism and advocacy going on in the immigrants' rights community to try to persuade, you know, the federal officials to actually enact comprehensive immigration reform to provide more of an answer for local and state jurisdictions so that they don't feel like they need to resort to these very extreme measures that we're seeing all over the country. The good news, too, is that for the first time in 40 years, in part led by budgetary crises at the state level, a lot of states are rethinking their addiction to incarceration and understanding that there are better ways to protect public safety. And there have been, you know, slew of evaluated programs to address addiction and substance abuse and that kind of thing. And so there's a lot of room now, even among conservative lawmakers, to actually lead the charge on reforming a lot of our laws and policies that have resulted in us having the largest prison system in the country. So I think that there's a lot of room now in the areas of education, substance abuse, mental health treatment, and that kind of thing, to really expand their presence in communities and limit the presence of prison and trying to keep prison really as something of a last resort in communities.
And another issue that hits close to home, at least in Oregon, is, you know, decriminalizing marijuana, mm-hmm. which is passed in our neighboring states of Washington and Colorado. If we could achieve something like that in Oregon, how do you think that that would impact the mass incarceration situation here?
Yeah, you know, decriminalizing marijuana is an important thing because the arrest rates in this country, the ACLU just issued a huge, massive national report on marijuana possession arrest rates around the country, and the race disparities in those arrests are staggering. Blacks are 4 times more likely to be arrested, even though the U.S. government reports that communities use marijuana proportionate to their representation in the population, and yet blacks are 4 times more likely to get arrested. And so there's a real need to really rethink some of our drug policies. And it doesn't mean that kids should have access. There are all kinds of ways in which right now we're watching Washington very closely as they create a regulatory scheme that would be a better way of actually addressing drugs and drug use. And they're actually going to be funneling money saved from kind of police efforts that used to lead to arrests into substance abuse treatment. And the Washington Initiative prohibits access for kids, but it really kind of changes the whole scheme and the way that we think about things. The reality is, alcohol is far more dangerous in society than marijuana is. And if you look at car accidents, if you look at violent behavior, there's been a slew of studies that have been done to show this. Yet it was just a political move to when we kind of prohibited marijuana, and it's led to huge devastation in communities when there actually could be more public health solutions to addiction and abuse.
Which brings up another point. Jerry Brown, the governor of California, from what I understand, he's been curbing efforts to privatize the prison system.
The governor, Jerry Brown, is overseeing a prison system that the Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court, has declared grossly unconstitutionally overcrowded. And it is it's so overcrowded that a lot of the prisons have become scenes of violence. The prison administrators are having problems kind of administering rules and regulations in their prisons, and it's led to a huge human rights crisis in the state of California. It's quite rare for the Supreme Court to order depopulation of a state's prison. It's actually unprecedented. And now, though, what Governor Brown's response has been kind of disappointing. He's been trying to move prisoners into county facilities in order to bring the state levels down. But what he really needs to do is to do what a lot of Republican governors have been doing around the country, which is to rethink sentencing policies and to stop sending such low-level offenders into prison. To provide more alternatives to incarceration, more programs that have been evaluated to better protect our public safety, rather than to fuel the prison growth that has led to this severe crisis in California.
Why is it so overpopulated in California?
I mean, there are really 2 things that drive prison rates. One is the number of people coming into prison, and the second thing is the length of time that they're spending. And California has a slew of sentencing policies that have really increased the length of time that people spend in prison for the same offense. And so California's 3 strikes law, which up until last year allowed for people to serve life sentences for nonviolent offenses, was resulting in a huge number of people, thousands of people, serving life sentences for, meaning, you know, years and years and years in prison for nonviolent offenses. And they were, you know, it was an approach of arrest and incarcerate to the point where they were spending more on prison building than on their higher education system. And that has really led to the kind of situation that we see today that led to the litigation, the overcrowding litigation, Plata v. Brown, that led to the Supreme Court declaring an overcrowding crisis in California's prisons.
And across the country, or at least there have been hunger strikes in specific prisons, I think in Pelican Bay and Georgia, and how has that impacted these issues today?
I mean, what has happened in our prisons as they've become increasingly overcrowded is, as I said, prison management has really struggled to be able to keep up when they don't have the physical space to basically accommodate this number. And the reality is this is why there have been studies that have showed that prison actually makes people more dangerous because of the conditions in the prisons. And as part of the response, increasingly prison administrators in this country have turned to the use of throwing people into the hole or putting them into solitary confinement for mere disciplinary infractions. This can lead to people being in 23 hours a day isolation, physical isolation in tiny rooms. Oftentimes, these folks may have mental illness problems, so they have no access to treatment while they're in solitary confinement. And it's very easy to see how somebody's mental capacity could degrade even more in these kinds of conditions. And in Pelican Bay, their inmates finally said, it's so inhumane that we are going to organize ourselves and go on a hunger strike to protest these conditions. And that's what happened. And it led to national attention being drawn on these practices. At the American Civil Liberties Union, we have a big campaign to reduce the use of solitary because it's become just an overused response to manage people who may be expressing certain kinds of mental illnesses in the prisons, but also beyond. And
is it becoming the first response rather than the last resort?
Well, I mean, I think that in a lot of places, there is a real concern that prison administrators are turning to it far too quickly. And there's other ways to also reform solitary confinement, such that if you are attempting to punish someone in prison for their actions in prison, you can still give them access to treatment, to medical treatment, to mental health treatment. What is actually quite problematic is that in some states, people go straight from having been in solitary confinement for a period of time, sometimes 6 months, a year, straight back onto the streets with no transition program, no mental health adjustment. And, you know, frankly, if I were, you know, as part of a community, I don't want that. I think that people should be getting access to these services to the extent that we do not want prisons to become places that breed more crime or more kind of violence. This is entirely the wrong approach.
Are there any other things you wanted to mention?
I mean, I work for what's been really amazing to me is when I was in law school, there were very few South Asian and Asian American public interest attorneys that I could kind of name as models. And a good 15 to 20 years on, there are too many for me to count. Even at the American Civil Liberties Union, there are so many Asian American and South Asian American attorneys that it's really quite remarkable the number of us that are doing this work, often to serve and empower communities that may not even be Asian American, but that may be incredibly marginalized or vulnerable. And I think it's just been really exciting to see this increase in the number of people, the number of Asian Americans doing this work.
That's really wonderful to hear that. That's one uplifting thing that comes out of this conversation.
No, but I said we're going to be reversing. This is, I mean, as much as the problems are very big and of a big scale, I think for the first time in my career, I'm actually seeing the light at the end of the tunnel. And in part, that's been because there's been a lot of kind of untiring advocacy to change the surround, to change the culture, to affect the politics. And the discourse around these issues. And I think now when you look at the public sentiment around our drug policy, how draconian it's been, how ineffective it's been, and you look at kind of trends towards criminal justice reform, I'm really encouraged, and I think that we will hopefully kind of bring more reason and fairness into our criminal justice system very soon.
That's really great to hear. Do you have any stories from the road, anything that was but resulted in a big reward?
Yeah, when I started my career, I got involved in a set of drug cases out of the small town in Texas called Tulia, Texas, where about 46 people had been wrongfully arrested based on the uncorroborated word of an undercover narcotics officer. And it was just a terrible situation. I got involved 2 years after people had been convicted of drug crimes, very minor, low-level drug crimes. But there was no other evidence presented except for the word of this law enforcement. And my clients, the people who ended up becoming my clients, got sentences of 20, 30, 40, in one case of 90 years for these very low-level drug crimes. And I spent 2 years of my heart and soul working to build up a legal team, working with the media, going to court, trying to build a case to really turn this around. And when my clients got out of prison, it was a huge victory. Governor Rick Perry in Texas exonerated my clients. And yet, while all of that was just a great victory for my clients, for the men and women who had been wrongfully incarcerated, I felt at that point that I couldn't reverse the kinds of laws and practices that had led to them being so easily convicted and incarcerated. And today, doing this work, it's a very different climate where we actually are succeeding in changing these laws. It's just been really gratifying to be doing this work kind of 10 years on and to be having been a part of watching our culture change around these issues and now really feeling like there's an opportunity to turn this around and have a fairer system.
Well, thank you so much for chatting with me on APA Compass.
Great. Thank you very much.
That was Vanita Gupta, the Deputy Legal Director of the ACLU. I'm Sarika Mehta, and you're listening to APA Compass.